This is Steve Hurley, and welcome to the Pivotal Outdoors Podcast, discussing hunting, fishing, and outdoor pursuits, swapping stories and feeling alive.
All right, to all the listeners out there, I'm excited to welcome to the Pivotal Outdoors Podcast, Austin Manelik. I met Austin back in college when we were playing rugby together at Penn State. He's a hard dude, a go-getter, and an avid outdoorsman, so there's no surprise that he is an Alaskan. So, Austin, why don't you kind of give us a quick background on yourself and maybe Mission Alaska or whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah, all right. Well, born and raised Alaskan. Family was in Pennsylvania, and so when I graduated right here in Palmer, Alaska, from Colony High School, I always wanted to go to Penn State, and I got into Penn State through the rugby program. They had two positions basically back then for recruitment to get you in. So I got in. I played rugby there with my brother Og Dog. He let DF and the coach know, and I had a tryout for the USA U19s, and I made the cut, and then it was kind of a decision to keep going with USA U19s or go and play Penn State rugby. And I decided to go and play Penn State rugby and go to school there in the spring. And I believe that's where we met, was that first semester that I was there.
So yeah. Oh man, I didn't know you had the choice between those two. That's some real Penn State love.
Yeah, man, it was the only time I was ever going to be able to play contact sport with my brother, because he's always, 4 years ahead of me, or 3 years, I guess. I was a freshman and he was a senior and just getting ready to graduate. So, yeah, I got to play. That was kind of the big decision, is keep going with the USA U19s. And I made the selection, they get you down to 50 and then you go. And I believe that was the year that they were doing the World Cup, USA U19s World Cup. And I'm like, meh. If I'm good enough, I'll circle back to the USA stuff, which basically the love of hunting and the outdoors and being in Alaska really got in the way of athletics. And now they've just consumed my life. So instead of training for contact sports, I train year round for hunting and just hunting the great state of Alaska. And so Mission Alaska, that started in the end of basically undergrad, when I was getting ready to leave Penn State. I was trying to figure it out. This is kind of like the base jump off of television, social media marketing, digital marketing, content creation. It was all starting to be on the forefront. Was social media is not really saying traditional print advertisements back in 2010. Magazines, television, that's where you market. Well, I jumped on, made Mission Alaska, just an outdoor brand that tracked my adventures, a blog with YouTube webisodes. And this was even pre-Instagram. So I started doing that. Meanwhile, filming hunts for the outdoor industry, the shooting, hunting, outdoor trade industry, the outdoor TV shows. Basically, I started filming my own hunts in Alaska. And I just sold myself to all these production companies because I wanted my own TV show, but I didn't know the nuances of the business and how it all worked. And so eventually they said, yeah, cool moose, man. Cool little video you got there. You can be a cameraman. I'm like, sweet. Yeah, I'll take that job, getting paid to go and film these hunting shows. So that's where it all really started for me. And on the back burner, I was developing Mission Alaska and trying to navigate what the future was going to look like for advertisements and basically how the business was going to go, because digital wasn't a thing. Social media wasn't really a thing. And I just kind of morphed through there. I knew I wanted to make a living in the outdoors, not necessarily as a guide or an outfitter, but in, that's a same, but different. From the television and shooting, hunting, outdoor trade world. It's just brother, sister kind of, or brand to brand.
I figured no one better to talk to about Alaska than you for the draw system. So, for a lot of people listening, many people's fall hunts, they're kind of winding down, and this whole application season is here. It's upon us. And so if you want to hunt a western state, you need to kind of plan it out and prioritize things now. Just for the listeners, go ahead.
Just another excuse to spend some more money on hunting and conservation.
Yeah.
And White looks at the credit card bill like, what is this $500, charge to the state of Kansas? What is this? I don't even know if that, $500 is for the state of Kansas or Colorado or whatever. I just kind of swipe it and deal with the consequences and then try to make my plans if I get drawn for anything good. Cause a lot of times you pay up front for some of those, being like the bighorn sheep, you pay up front, like in the state of New Mexico, I don't know, like $2,000 or something like that, $3,000 in total. You pay for the full price. And then if you don't draw, they refund you. So it's kind of like credit cards go up. The old tally goes up pretty good between here and the spring.
And how you said $500, I didn't even balk at that because, it can get crazy for some of the species and areas you want to hunt. You got to play this points game.
Yeah, the points game, and there's others, like, even if it's not a points game, you've got to get in the application just to even get, like, a non-resident tag for a different state. Even if it's an over-the-counter tag for all these units, you've got to get in the draw just to get the tag.
Yeah.
And that's not even just, like, a way mega primo area. That's just to get the tag. Like, in Kansas, you get to pick a couple different units, and you usually get drawn. But that's just to get the tag, like a lot of the over the counter is going away. It seems, I mean, Pennsylvania, you can still go and get a deer tag right over the counter, buck tag, and that's all good. In Alaska, you can come up and, fly up here and get a moose tag over the counter, depending on if Walmart has it or Sportsman's Warehouse or wherever. I've had to do that before. I told people, hey, come on up. We fly out tomorrow, and then we drive to every single grocery store, Fred Meyer's, Cars. They all have the tags, but they're all out of moose tags because everybody grabs them. But they're still available, and now you can actually print them off online. So the whole tag process and being able to hunt is really interesting. They say that hunters are, we're on the, on the decline, but I don't even know how that's possible. How many people that I've seen in the field and just across the country, really, there's a lot of people who are hunting these days. And it seems like the advent of technology and people understanding the game of getting your tags and, ease of computers. And just seems like a lot of people are in the know.
Yeah. And the thing is, draw odds, they usually get worse year to year. So that's another thing, like, okay, there's got to be, more people knowing about this and acting on it. I kind of just want to talk about the – so we kind of talked on points. And for most states, there's, a couple – there's random draw. There's, like, a preference point, which is each year you get a point, you don't draw, and you get moved to the front of the line. And then the bonus point is essentially just like extra raffle tickets in the hat. Sometimes they're squared,
Yeah. So for that being said, I know some guys who have been putting in for bighorn sheep in Montana their entire lives, and they've maxed out the preference points, and they don't get drawn. And here you got some kid who puts in one time, his first time ever, and he draws the tag on, just the luck of the draw, I guess. But Alaska's random, so you can't get points in Alaska. But your draw odds are very low, depending on the hunt. And some people are like, at the very, back of the, hunt supplement, the draw hunting supplement, there's like a page with all the different permits and your percentage, like how many people put in last year and then how many tags were given out and the percentage. And some people chase a percent, for like toke sheep. One year it was, I don't know, 1%. The next year was 3%. And some people are like, oh, it's going to be 3%. Well, that was, you know, last year. So you got all these people who put in for, they're chasing the percentage, but you got to think other people are going to be putting in for that. And then the following year, it's going to be back down to 0.01%. So,
and the,
I don't know.
The crazy thing is, I hear 3%. I'm like, ooh, that's some good odds. When it comes to these really, you know, these animals that are very limited, you know, like sheep, goat, at least Shiras moose down here in 48. You know, it's just, it's crazy. But I guess the fact is that you got to play this application game, you know, points or not.
Oh, yeah.
And so right now, Alaska.
I don't gamble, but I do for animals, I guess.
Well, I'm in the same boat. I hate gambling, but I get excited for application season. I love, even across the states, I love just reading odds and you know, good winners, bad winners, and you know, trying to watch trends. It's like a weird appreciation. Like, I get excited for that.
The digital hunter, I tell a lot of people, like, yeah, dude, 95% of my hunt is already done by the time I get there. All I have to do is show up and execute the game plan, and hopefully the time that I have, I've got a good weather window to go and do that. So it's already done, man. All the topographic maps, all of the gear, everything's already planned. It's already just, okay, here we go. Just got to show up and do it. So yeah, I've got an immense appreciation for it. And then every single time the draw odds come out, or the draws, the results, it's something to like really look forward to. So in Alaska, the period is December 15th this year, from December 15th to I believe February 15th is when the draws come out. It opens in November, closes in December, and then the draw odds come out in February, which is like a second Christmas. So, but I never get my hopes up at all. And then, because anytime I do, I never draw anything. The best times I've ever drawn anything is when my buddies hit me up. They're like, dude, you drew a muskox, you drew a goat, you drew this. I'm like, what? No. And then sure enough, I go on like, no way, I drew a muskox. Holy cow. You know, something I've been putting in for 12 years, max it out every single time, 12 years, point, you know, just around 1% odds, maybe a little bit less, like, you know, 0.06% or something, depending on the given year. And I drew it. I finally drew it. And then, it's kind of funny. I told all my friends, like, hey, you should put in for muskox. They're like, okay, I'll put in. And then three of my friends draw it the following year. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. So they're all gearing up, getting ready to go. Here in March, end of February, March timeframe to go for muskox.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I mean, and even you saying it took 12 years to draw, that's still amazing. I mean, you could easily be still going right now without drawing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I chatted with, there's a transporter down there. And basically how it works in Nunavak is, in McCoryuk. Nunavak Island, McCoryuk, Alaska, you fly in, but you have to go transported. Basically they've got all of the snow machines there. It's very hard to get a snow machine over there. And they've got all the snow machines on the island sewed up. So you can't just show up and rent a snow machine. You've got to go transported. So it's just their way of making some money there on the island, which is great. They certainly need the economy. But it's a very interesting hunt, and I would call it more of a harvest than a hunt. The hunt, a lot of people miss that hunt. You know, they say you miss $100 bills flying over your head if you're busy picking up the pennies off the ground. Is the hunt, you show up and these animals, their instinct is to turn and fight you and just sit there. Which is why they, basically went extinct in the state of Alaska. And are, you know, the muskox actually come from Greenland. So, and then they were out on that island and they got repopulated, and they've been using those muskox to repopulate different places across Alaska. So it's kind of an interesting story, you know, straying away from the draw, but it was just one of those things that I did draw, and it's like, okay, you draw it one time in your lifetime, you're doing it, and you got to go. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, you say, you know, they turn and face you. That's unlike pretty much almost everything else you hunt. You know, I mean, you're worried about spooking things and getting busted and them just taking off. So that is a different, I mean, I would think maybe like, yeah, maybe brown bear or something would kind of face up on you, but that's got to be different where you're like, they see you, you see them, and it's like, they're not hightailing it.
No, they might do a brief little run, and then it's so flat and there's no brush, there's nothing to hide behind. They can kind of hide behind some of the hills there, but they're like, okay, I'm going to get really tired and I'm not going to be able to outrun this thing, you know? So I'll just stand here and fight. You know, they go butt to butt and they put their young ones in the middle of the circle, and they stand there, you know, in a big circle trying to fend off the wolves or whatever. But yeah, there's no wolves on that island or natural predators other than humans, which is, you know, cause it's out in the middle of nowhere off the western coast of Alaska, and the wolves can't get across. So there might be a wolf or two or a moose or two that will stray over there across the flats in the middle of winter, but they get killed pretty quickly if they step out of line. So it's an interesting hunt. You know, it's one of those once in a lifetime hunts, and if you draw it, you gotta go.
Oh yeah. So, I guess you said the wolves, if they do stray, they don't last too long. I guess what, just because villagers, they want to protect, mm-hmm. you know,
oh, yeah.
their livelihood and muskox and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's the drill. And they all ride around on snow machines. They'll run that thing to death. And there's some foxes over there, but they don't have any impact on the muskox. But yeah, it's interesting. Those muskox in like Alaska animals are much bigger, obviously. You do have blacktails, and those are little guys, and foxes and coyotes. But I don't know. In Alaska, when you go on these hunts, your decision making could be life and death. Just about everything you do, and logistics are everything, because you're going to be far away. So any medical emergencies or anything, yeah, you might have the outfitter or the transporter on speed dial with a sat phone, but if you can't get out, they can be dire. So it's interesting. You know, in Alaska, I operate, you know, us both playing Penn State rugby and, you know, playing contact sports, you've got this adrenaline flow almost every day. Even if you're at practice, you got an adrenaline rush, you know?
Yeah.
And this day and age, I don't get that as much. Just I'm not playing sports, trying to minimize my injuries so that I can pack out big moose and sheep off the mountain or, you know, bears. It's just kind of, that is what it is. Yeah. But my adrenaline it doesn't get spiked in those high situations, like those high intensity situations. And maybe it does get spiked, but it's at such a level. It enters like in football, you're all nervous, you know, you're nervous going up to the game. And then the first hit, you're like, oh, okay, yep, all good. Then you're just on this constant flow of adrenaline running around. Well, in Alaska, it's like you get out the truck and you start moving. And that's what it feels like to me. And like, you know, any encounter that I have with a moose or a bear, a sheep, when I'm climbing the mountain, it's all on this, it's on another level. Of, okay, every step that you make, every decision you make with your rifle or your bow, whatever it may be, could be life and death. So I'm on this like plane of constant adrenaline flow. And then I go to hunt whitetails, and, you know, I'm working on a theory right now, buck fever theory. I'll go and hunt whitetails. I'm sitting in a tree stand, and with a rifle, no problem. With a compound, no problem. I can get excited after, but I've got a recurve in my hand. They get so close and they're coming in, and I'm calling them, working them. And when I'm in a tree stand, I lose my mind. I can't even handle it. It's so much, like, I'm starting to shake. I'm like, get it together. But it's like, it's not as critical. You know what I mean? It's not as life and death, when you're staring down a whitetail at 20 yards, because if you blink, if your jaw hair catches your, you know, corner of your jacket and it makes a noise and they look up and there they go. There's your opportunity. It's done. It's like, I don't know. It's like not enough adrenaline for me. And I just don't know how to handle it, you know? So this year I was just in Kansas, which, you know, talking about the draws, I drew Kansas, but I went with my recurve. So I've been going and trying to kill a buck with a recurve because in college I killed someone with a rifle and a compound and a crossbow. Then it was like, oh yeah, like I get jacked up after the shot, sure. But for some reason, I've blown it so many times with a recurve that I lose my mind. So this year I was like, all right, I need to put myself ground level with these whitetails. I need to be in that fight or flight. And I, you know, sitting in a tree stand with a recurve, it's different than a rifle or a compound. It's like my flight response is triggered. And, you know, I want to get away. I want to get away. Instead of, okay, I need to bear down and fight this thing and kill it. It's him or me. So this year in Kansas, I tested my theory to the maximum. I got drawn, and then I'm sitting there on the ground with these whitetails, spot and stock, and everything is so critical that, you know, you make a you're in full stealth mode the whole time. And this year I had a couple of encounters with big bucks on the ground where I was decoying them, rattling them, and bringing them right to me, right in my lap. And I was cool as a cucumber. And granted, they got downwind of me at 20 yards in the thick stuff, and then I couldn't get a shot. And but some monster bucks, some big bucks, you know, anything from 150 to, there was one that was up to the 180s, which he would have been dead with a rifle 10 times over. Never even got him in compound range, but big bucks to me. I mean, some people are looking for the 200. I'm, you know, looking for a mature deer. I passed on some at 5 yards. You know, a Pennsylvania classic, Pennsylvania 8, just outside his ears, number 2 pencil. I had him right there, you know, 5 yards from me, but he was a 2.5-year-old and,
yeah, you know, looking for something. You know, so like you said, like more, you know, if you're going representative of the area, you got to kind of take that into account, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on that last day, I saw this rickety old tree stand where I brought my harness with me, but that day I left it in the truck and I see this rickety old wood tree stand about 10 feet up. I'm like, I'm going to try this out. Let me get up in the stand, first light. And if I fall, I just, you know, just be an athlete. It's not much, you know, different than sitting on a 10-foot rock out in, you know, the forest of PA out there, Allegheny National Forest. I'm like, yeah, I'll be all right if I fall. Toss the bow, try to land on your feet, tuck and roll. But wouldn't you know it, here comes a whitetail. I grunted, I had my decoy out, but he couldn't get downwind of me without entering this big field. And he heard it. He couldn't smell me. He could see it, but it wasn't moving. And, you know, I spent 10 minutes with him, you know, at 20 yards, but just in the broccoli, you know, where I couldn't get a shot. I could see him. I could see his antlers. But I never got a clear shot at his whole body.
Oh, man.
And, I was just shaking like a freaking leaf up there. I'm like, dude, calm down. Calm down. Like, he can see me. He can hear me. I'm done. I'm like, am I even going to be able to draw this bow? Like, and then, of course, you know, he circles downwind at 40 yards or, no, excuse me, into the wind, and just kind of walks out, jumps the fence from private or from public into private, and then he was off limits. But I could have probably shot him with a compound right there. Well, I know I could have shot him with a compound before he jumped the fence. But there he goes, walks off, facing the wind. See you later. And so my theory of, you know, buck fever theory is, I guess it's got to be really intense. I got to trigger my fight response versus my flight response. And I'm still working on the theory. So I haven't killed a whitetail outside of Pennsylvania with a recurve. And that's my big goal. So meanwhile, we're talking about draws in Alaska. I'm looking at whitetails and going to lower 48 to kind of keep it spicy.
Yeah, no, I feel that. And I'm also dabbling with the whole recurve for this year, and I'm actually having a little trouble. I went to a bow shop. I'm not going to name which one to protect them. But, you know, I've got a new string for this recurve, and I'm like, okay, cool. I need some arrows with some, you know, some of the feather fletchings instead of, like, the rubbers or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
rubber blazers or anything. So, so the guy's like, oh, this is what you need right here. I'm like, okay. Spine seems a little soft, a little flexible. And I'm like, okay, well, this is what he recommends, whatever. Shoot it for 2 days, put 200 arrows through it. And then I started noticing there's some fraying above where you knock it. And I was like, man, this is crazy. So I should have done the research beforehand, but started looking up afterwards. I'm like, I'm not dry firing it. So I look up, you know, a chart, a recurve chart, not just a compound chart, but specifically recurve. And they're saying the spine that I need for like my setup, poundage at draw, is like a 300 spine instead of like this 500. So I'm like, man, I'm just shooting too flexible of an arrow where I'm doing damage. So now I'm like trying to go back, get another string, find some new arrows. You know, it's a process, you know? And so that's,
yeah, I would go, to Big Jim's Bow Company.
Yeah.
And they'll get you dialed up. I don't know what, this is the witchery of archery. Maybe he did, you know, a 500 spine would work if you've got like a heavier grain fill point up front or a heavier broadhead. And anything flying off the shelf. Yeah, I guess there's these new, trad veins, but they're not new. They've been around. It's just kind of a marketing ploy. and I won't mention that, but, feathers have been around and they fly great off the shelf because they compress. They also compress when they go over limbs. Like, yeah, it'll affect your flight if you hit a small, limb or any arrow will, but they don't grab as much as those, veins do. So basically shoot off the shelf, your feathers will compress and go over that shelf and, they'll be affected less than the rubber veins. And then there's some rubber veins that are meant for compounds that will absolutely send your arrow wild. So I don't know. It's the witchery of archery, man. Some people use, you know, a heavier spined arrow that weighs a little bit more with a lesser, grain tip up front and they get great arrow flight. But really what you got to do is bear shaft, tune your equipment before, and, you know, shoot your paper and make sure you're not getting tears with a bare shaft shooting perfectly. And then you go from there, then out on your fletching. You might have to trim your arrow depending. And it's just, yeah, another thing to throw money at. So yeah, it's, what pound bow are you shooting?
It is, hold on, I should know it off the top of my head. It is, I guess it's 50 pounds at 28 inches.
Okay, 50 at 28. So 500 grain should work. Or, you know, 500 spine, 500 series should work if you've got the right field point. What field point? What grain field point are you using?
It was a 125 grain.
Yeah. See, you're going to need something 175. You buy a bunch of different ones, 150, 175, and even up to 200, and then start shooting different weight field points up front. that'll probably help you out there. But what you're looking for with any trad bow is, you know, somebody could pick me apart on all this, but as I listen to Big Jim, basically you want 10 grains per pound of bow. So if you've got a 50-pound bow, you're going to want at least a 500-grain arrow for a 50-pound bow. That's what you need. If it's too light, then you will be doing damage to your bow 100%. So 10 grains per pound of bow, pound of draw.
Yeah.
So if that helps you at all, just a good rule of thumb.
Oh, it definitely does. I actually just typed that down as a little note to my tweaking that I got to do. So,
And then if you have heavier, some of those bows, you'll shoot, out of a 50-pound bow, shooting a 600 grain arrow. Some people like those heavier arrows for the mass and penetration and, you know, you lose a little bit of speed, but if your arrow is flying with authority, if it's coming out of your bow straight, that's why you paper tune it at close, you know, close range, paper turn, if it is coming out of your bow straight, in theory, you wouldn't even need fletchings, but the fletchings help to stabilize your arrow when it gets out there. But if you're, that's, if you've got a little bit of imperfection in your draw, or it's just not spined correctly, the feathers or fletching will crack your arrow down range. But what happens if you shoot a deer at 10 yards? Here he comes. You shoot a deer at 10 yards, and when you shoot, your arrow is kicked off a little bit to the left. That's not, you're not going to get the penetration as if it's flying like a bullet straight right out of your bow. So you heard people, man, I smacked this deer right behind the shoulder. It didn't hit the shoulder. I got no penetration. Well, the arrow was, it flies where you want it to, but it's not flying with authority correctly. It's flying a little bit to the left, or, you know, it's kicked up if your knocking point's not right, or, you know, if it's spined too heavily, too heavy of a spine, it's going to be coming off to the right, you know, or to the left. It's the witchery of archery, man. Even when you get into it, it's pretty immense. And then if you don't draw your bow, if you short draw it in the moment with buck fever, you short draw it, then it's not going to come out and fly effectively. So that's why every little thing counts. Really sharp broadheads. Pray you don't hit a rib. You know, all these different things really come into account with archery. It's much different than, you know, blasting some with a rifle, which I really enjoy doing. I really like rifles. Yeah.
So I think that, I mean, the appreciation would just be that much more with the recurve. And like I was lucky enough, got a buck this year, but I'm trying to in PA, and I'm trying to do a late season archery hunt in the special regs area near where I'm at, and I'm taking the recurve, and the whole time I'm thinking, I mean, it's going to be cold. I want to look, you know, be looking for like some food. And if I get a doe with the recurve, that might mean more. I think it's going to mean more to me than the buck I got.
Oh yeah.
So it's funny, yeah. You know, what people kind of value. I mean, I to me, they're all trophies, but I think I value the process of, you know, the idea of, man, taking someone with a recurve, that's just, it's just raw and pure, and it's natural, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get it, man. I'm the older I get, the less ego I have. You know, ego influences all aspects of life, but I've become more of an experience hunter. Like in the past, you know, hunting rifle season, I'm hunting with a rifle. Running in archery seasons, yeah. I've got a love for traditional archery, but man, those cable guns, modern compound bow, those are effective killing devices, no doubt. And so it meant more to me to kill one than it did the size or the experience or the who and the why more than the what.
Yeah.
So that's why I've been hunting whitetails with a recurve, because I got a monkey on my back. I've killed them with just about everything other than, and doing it self-guided and with a recurve, it doesn't really matter what size buck. And this year we're on a lease, and it had rules. The lease had rules. You can't shoot 2-year-olds, and you can only shoot 3-year-olds if they're an 8-point. But if it's a 3-year-old and it's bigger than an 8-point, if it's a 10-point, you can't shoot him because he's going to be a monster.
Wait, what?
And then anything yeah,
oh,
I know.
Man.
Yeah,
so,
I know.
So now you have to run this through your thought process. When they might just pass him through, you're like, all right, I got 10 seconds. Yeah, shoot,
yeah.
No shoot. Boom. You know, yeah. Like that adds to the stress of it.
Oh, yeah. It's like, man, I would have been really happy to shoot that number 2 pencil 8-point with my recurve 100%, came to 5 yards. And I was cool as a cucumber. I could have, you know, drawn that bow and zapped him. And that would have been great. But, yeah, long story short, I wasn't allowed to shoot him there. So then I was like, all right, well, then I started leaving the lease because I wasn't seeing any big deer, and any of the deer that were on trail camera were coming through at night. And I hunted my chunk very hard. And, I mean, I'll put it this way. I slipped in on a bobcat to 20 yards. I was full ninja, dude. Painted up, you name it, decoy, just stealth. And
dude, that would have been tempting. Take a bobcat with a recurve at 20. That would have been gnarly.
Oh, man. You know, yeah. Well, I didn't have the fur bear license, so yeah. I got him watch up squirrels, which is cool. But yeah, I slipped up on him, which is yeah, it was, that was sweet. But the experience of it all is what I was chasing. So I decided, man, I've been to Texas and different places in Texas with leases and private property where they've got, it's not game laws, it's house rules. This is what you can, can't shoot. And, you know, here's a buck in Texas. I got a rifle and I'm like, I'm scared to shoot the thing because I'm going to, you know, piss somebody off. I'm like, man, that's a bummer. And out here, if a, you know, a 160 10.3 year old comes walking by the 5 yards, you expect me not to get to full draw with, you know, with very bad intentions on that deer. You know, it's like, I couldn't do it. So I'm like, well, even if I see something, it's a 3 year old, whatever, I'm going to go and hunt public where I can shoot whatever I want. And then I ended up hunting the public and had better encounters than I did at the lease. And the lease had other people coming through. They were there, you know, they'd hunted 10 days before us and there was no break. And, you know, so they had spooked a lot of the deer off and I'm like, oh, great. So we're coming into a lease 100 acres apiece, you know, 100 acre to 140 per person. And
highly pressured.
Highly pressured. I'm like, I'm over it. I'm going to go and hunt. And then everyone at the lease was kind of like, man, why are you doing that? And I'm like, I'll hunt the mornings at the lease and then I'm out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I had way better encounters and I ended up just going and hunting full days. My last few days, just hunting the full shebang away from the lease, figuring out, you know, I'm not going to pressure them as hard. They might cruise in. And then like the last day of the lease, I hunted the lease incredibly tough and covered every square inch and walked up on, small bucks, you know, some porkies at 20 yards and, just creeping in on them. And, so that was that. I didn't see any mature bucks over there, and no, yeah, that's fine. It was the best whitetail hunt I have ever had, ever been a part of, and I'll be putting in for Kansas again and going down there if my marriage will allow it.
Yeah, and that's a whole another topic of just hunting with a family. You know, that could be a whole another podcast we do separately with kids and wives and all that stuff.
Well, that's so you get you one that's into hunting, and then you can be, oh, we're going to go to Hawaii for a little vacation. It's like, okay, yeah, sounds great. Why are you bringing your bow? Well, I got us hunting licenses. Why don't we, you know, do a little bit of the best of both worlds. Actually, our Hawaii trip, get out of Alaska and go thaw the bones out, that got canceled this last March because of Shmovid, the China virus. So that was a bummer, and that's where my wife was going to, you know, be up and be able to hunt. She wasn't pregnant then, but, we're going to go do that. So getting the wives involved really helps the travel and, the best of both worlds type of deal.
Yeah. And so right now I got, you know, like I got three real young kids and so it's to get away. My wife's been great, but I know it puts a little stress on the family. And, you know, my kids, you know, we've gone changed trail cameras and put out traps and, you know, I try to get them out there when we can, knowing we're probably not going to see anything because my kids are screaming the whole time. But, she's like, yeah, I'm excited for the day where they can hunt and you can just take all the kids. You take a trip with three kids. I'll be like, oh, okay. So, I guess I'll have to roll with that, you know? So I'm trying to get some of my personal hunting in. Good hunting now, and then kind of rotate back again once they're old enough to hunt. Let them be a shooter, you know.
Yeah, and you want them to be, but then you know, you got three kids. There's all this excitement, and it's tough, and you want them to be successful at the same time, being quiet and getting her done. Versus, let's go out. We always go hunting, but we never get anything, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, training them upright, that's not what you need to have a good hunt, but eventually they're going to want to get something. And then when they do, then they're hooked. If you do it right, don't make them cold. And you know, it's a whole nother. Ball game.
I was thinking squirrels and spring turkey, you know, warm weather and a bunch of action. So, I mean, it's moving in the right direction. I know we're getting sidetracked. I got a quick story though. We've been trapping. And, you know, I got to check the traps every day. And I've just been taking my daughter just to get her out of the house and stuff. And we caught our, I guess it was the second fox this year. My daughter was with me, and I'm like, oh, man, okay. You know, so, like, she got to kind of see it, like, go near the trap. She got to see it moving around. And then, like, we handled it and everything, dispatched it. And then she was surprisingly, like, really cool with everything. And she was like, you know, Dad, can I get a picture with it? So, I mean, she was asking for grip and grins without me even mentioning it. And I'm like, yeah, sure, you know. And she's, like, smiling. And then, you know, we're leaving where we get our traps. We go home. Saw, like, her cousins or something. And she's going around bragging about it. She's like, well, I got a fox today. So, you know, I know, you know, trapping kind of gets a bad rap now and then and makes people uncomfortable. But I'm glad, you know, I'm glad my daughter's embracing the outdoors at least and excited about it.
Yep, it's good stuff, man. That's good stuff. That's what it's all about. Little Keeper, he's my son. He's, you know, I shot a bear, I gutted it, but the next day I shot it, you know, it was very late. I had daddy daycare the next day where, we didn't have kid care at the time. So I just loaded him up with the bear, you know, first thing in the morning we went out and we sliced and diced that bear on a riverbank. You know, I brought a bug net and a, little iPad for him to, you know, watch TV. It says TV. Don't watch TV. And, you know, slice and dice that whole bear right there, right in front of him. And now he's walking around saying, I shoot the bear. I shoot the bear. Yeah, he's into hunting, walks around the house with his, little lever action toy gun, you know, shooting all the mounts and whatnot. So, before you know it, he'll be in the draw process and even not being in the draw process, I'll be taking him out doing a lot of DIY stuff because you don't need to draw to go and have a great hunt. So that's what, you know, we're talking about Alaska and, you know, the draw is a lot of people, oh yeah, I'll try to go 1 year. By the time you're ready to go, if you don't get drawn, you can still go and you can still hunt public areas. But if you're not putting in for the permits for these juicy areas, you could wait a lifetime. Oh, I'll go do it eventually. And then your eventually turns into, yeah, I was going to go, but I never did.
And that would haunt me.
Yeah. Well, so Nab, you know, we played Penn State rugby together. He's, you know, he was my best friend out there. And he came up. I was like, well, hey, you can come. I drew a moose tag. And as a resident, there's other areas that you can register to hunt. But if you don't put in and draw as a non-resident, you won't be able to hunt moose, but you can hunt bear there, just over the counter. And he's like, sweet. So he came up, no expectations. He's just like, I just want to show up, have the right gear and just be a part of it. Let's do it. And he just dove in the best, absolute best, just, you know, attitude coming to the hunt. And he bucked up, dude. We shot moose together. He helped pack. He went shoulder deep, you know, gutting the moose, and he just loved it. He even got an opportunity at a couple of different black bears. Shot one in a downpour. We couldn't find it. And, you know, we were hands and knees for hours looking for this thing. And couldn't find it. No blood. It was just, it was one of those days, just an absolute downpour. Went back, couldn't find it. And it was a bummer, but that was his first, big hunt that he's ever done. He went and he got the hunter safety. He came out and he did it. And now he's out. He's like, man, that was an awesome experience. And now he's out there hunting deer on his own in Pennsylvania, going and hunting Potter County out in, some of the state game lands and forests out there. So he's hooked, man. And he's 30 years old, just got into hunting. So it's,
I hope he's not pretty ruined, toxic. You know, starting with Alaska, I hope he's not all downhill from there.
Yeah, right. Well, I know he wants to come back with us next time. When he comes back, he's like, yeah, I want a moose tag. I'm like, all right, well, yeah. you better put in. So I believe that he put in and hopefully he gets drawn eventually, but it's, you know, low draw odds. But I told him, yeah, man, I actually started a transportation business. I've been doing the Yukon river, and just realize a lot of these people who draw don't even have the opportunity to go out and go and get these animals. Logistics, it's a big drink of water, man. It's a tall pool or a deep pool, and a lot of people don't even know where to begin when they go out, don't see anything, and they get really discouraged. So it's kind of interesting. Alaska draws, the transportation, and the different aspects of Alaska that make it so unique is that it's not a bunch of private land like PA. You got a bunch of private land, and some of the best hunting is on private land. Yeah, you can go to state, national forests and hunt different areas, special areas. But in Alaska, the land is so open, and if you're hunting private, usually that's not a good thing. If you're hunting private and hunting locally, that means you're probably not going to see anything. So how Alaska is controlled is by the transporters and outfitters. They'll take you to a spot, and they'll protect other spots based on their relationships with other outfitters. So that's what's kind of unique about Alaska is you got guys who want to come do unguided adventures, draw a tag, and, hey, I want to go here, here, and here. And the transporter's like, ooh, I can't take you there because somebody's already there. I can't take you there, somebody's already there. But I can take you over here, which is, you know, out of a guide's area, essentially. So I've kind of gotten some heat from the guide outfitter individuals over the years based on me going and getting into spots based on my relationships with transporters. And then even like kind of blowing the lid on that's how Alaska is controlled. You've got guides who are trying to manage certain areas based on transportation and getting that far out, whether it's by boat, Super Cub, four-wheeler, pack horses, you name it. Some of these areas are just really hard to get to. And you're only as good as your relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I think a lot of people, at least, you know, over here in the East Coast, I mean, like you said, the transport service being so important. I mean, like anywhere you hunt in PA, there's going to be a road at least a couple miles away, you know, it's hikeable at least. So, when people think Alaska, I mean, it's so vast, you know, they think, oh, it's going to be expensive, you know, but all, I mean, you can go to the website. It's very clear. You know, apply for a tag. You can order a flight. People do order flights all the time. But that daunting part is the transport. And it's like,
Yeah. You're
like, I don't know where to start. I mean, what if, you know, there's so many different variables that could go wrong, or even just, you know, I know a lot of people, they go with certain guide services and they have a really bad experience and they didn't know what they're getting into, really. Really, the guide's like, hey, you get what you see, and this was my plan all along. I don't know what you had planned, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, and once you do, if you're all by yourself, the laws are different in Alaska. I mean, you got to take everything. If they can cut a sandwich baggie of meat off the carcass when you're all done, you get hit with a wanton waste fine and, you know, a game violation or several. And then if you transport that animal across state lines, then it becomes federal. And you got the Lacey Act. You got all these things. It's not meant to scare people, but it's very real, man. When you step across state lines and you're not in your back 40 and you're out here, you got a gigantic animal that's over 1,000 pounds. You're moving, you know, 600 to 800 pounds of meat at least. You got to take the neck. You got to take all the rib meat. You got to take all edible meat from this animal, which is different from a lot of states of, oh, well, you don't got to eat the ribs. You don't have to take the neck. You don't even got to take the interior back straps, which that should be a crime in itself.
Yeah.
So
it's just good eating there.
You know, yeah. So it's really interesting. Alaska's interesting. It's a big place. And the state of Alaska's website is legit from planning your hunt. There's a hunt planner. There's maps. There's topo maps that dial it in. And then you don't have to necessarily draw a juicy tag to go get into great hunting.
Yeah. And so I'm glad you were on to talk about that, because, I mean, I think if people know about, hey, if I can line this up, this transporter, that alleviates so much stress and I can just focus on, you know, getting out there and, you know, tactics and gear and everything else. So I'm glad to hear you're doing that. When we talked a few weeks ago, you know, we're talking about Alaska, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's so awesome. You know, you have my curiosity, but then when you said, oh, I'm dabbling in doing the transport service, then you had my attention. I was like, oh, okay, now this is something I got to start really looking at. Before it's too late.
Yeah. Before it's too late, I say go do it now. Get in there and get the tag, and then go and do it, whatever you got to do, however much money you got to set aside to be able to make it happen. Because the draws are just getting harder to pick up these tags, and if you wait until you're good and 50 and you're like, okay, then you get there and you're like, oh man, I wish I would have hunted this 10 years ago when I had the back to do it, the energy to grind for, you know, 10 days straight. And it's really even more than that. I mean, you're at the airport, you're moving your bags, you're moving all this gear, and then you get it, you go get your animal, and then you move the animal, and then you gotta move the gear, and you gotta do all this stuff where it is. You know, there's some hunts that's an old man's game, but there's some hunts that are definitely the young man's game for sure.
Yeah, and I would think Alaska is definitely the young man's game. Not like a flatland pronghorn hunt or anything, which I'm not knocking. Oh. I'd still love to do that, but I'm just saying it's a different beast.
Oh, different altogether. Different altogether, man. It's no joke. And generally speaking, the general, you know, the over-the-counter tags, they're going to be tougher to find the animal and tougher to get them out, more logistically challenging. And then some of these other permits off the Yukon, the fly-ins, the generals, it's just more heavy on the logistics side. And you might shoot a moose that's closer to transportation, or any critter that's closer to transportation, even a caribou. You know, it's endless. And on the species that you can do unguided in Alaska are moose, caribou, black bear, and black tails. Did I say caribou? Caribou as well. Okay, so that's what you can hunt unguided. And then you have to be guided for grizzly bear / brown bear, mountain goats, and dall sheep. Those are the three that you need to have a guide for before you even apply for anything. You have to have a guide. He gives you a pin. And then you can enter the draws with that pin, but there's just a lot of, you know, over the counter sheep hunts that you can still do, but you have to have that pin. And, the other thing that a lot of people don't know about Alaska is if you draw a tag or even if you get a moose tag, for example, you have your paper tag and your locking tag. So in Alaska, you can harvest an animal for non-residents. You can take an animal of equal to or lesser value of your tag that you get, and then you can put your locking tag on that animal. So let's say you have a moose tag with a moose locking tag, and then you're in an area where there's a caribou. You can shoot that caribou and put your locking tag on it, but before you go into the field, you have to have had printed out your caribou harvest card, your paper card for caribou, which isn't it's not additional money to print that out, but, you know, they're not just giving away free caribou, but you have to print that out, and then you can put your locking tag on that animal. Otherwise, if you're going to hunt moose and caribou, you get your moose locking tag and your caribou locking tag. If that makes sense, non-residents have these metal locking tags that you put on the carcass of the animal, and you have to have the printed version for the animals you're going for, at least.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I'm glad you said that, because if there was a guy just doing a DIY hunt, I could see them easily messing that up by not printing that paper form, like the example from Canada. I could see that being a problem if you don't know.
Or, oh, here's a black bear. Day 9 of my 10-day moose hunt. Here's a black bear. Yep, I could shoot him. You shoot him and you put your locking tag on him, but you don't have your paper black bear tag, then you just committed a game violation. So that's something to think about when you go out. Whatever animal is out there in the field, you know, I suggest getting the highest tag for, if you don't want to cop up the change for two tags, you just get the highest value tag with your locking tag, and then you print out everything you could possibly see, and then I would get a moose or a wolf tag, no matter where you go in Alaska. no matter what, I would get a wolf tag and a locking tag, like a wolf paper ticket and then a paper tag and then a locking, metal locking tag for wolves, because I think they're only $50. So in Kodiak, you won't see any wolves, but anywhere else in the state, even in the southeast, you can run into wolves. And it's like, man, I don't want to put my moose tag on a wolf, but here is a wolf at 50 yards. It's just kind of like a additional bonus. If you see a wolf, shoot it. But you got to have, obviously, you got to have all the correct paperwork.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I kind of did something similar this Colorado hunt I went on earlier this year. I'm not locking tags, but I just picked up an over-the-counter bear tag. It's like $100, and I'm like, you know what? Who knows? Maybe we, you know, we quarter it out, we come back for the second load, and there's a bear there. You know, so I was like, just in case, might as well pick it up. I mean, if you're going out there, make the most of it, right?
Yeah. You never know. And a lot of the times, that's when you see him and you don't have the tag, and you're like, you've got to be kidding me. I should have got that. Yeah. And then the times you buy the tag, you never see him. Tight.
That's how it goes.
Yeah, so tight. But yeah, so this whole points draw system, it's a pretty fun aspect as you get more serious into hunting. It's, you know, you're starting to make these plans, and if, you know, I see a lot of guys who are like, man, I'm looking for something different. I'm washed up on my athletics. I'm not going to be playing any sports anymore. But I want to get out and go do stuff. And I know it pulls a lot of dudes, out of that depression that you find yourself in from time to time. Like, man, what's next? I go to the gym and I work out. Cool. I go home. You know, where's the trips with the boys? You know, no longer playing Surfside Sevens and all these different things. It's like, rugby's great. You can play it. If you play at the level that we did, once I got done, I was done. I'm like, nope, no more, man. That's a kill or be killed mentality.
Yeah.
So that
was sort of the peak for me. I kind of messed around with some men's clubs a little bit afterwards. And not knocking them, you know, hey, that was fun and stuff. But, like, just the seriousness that we took, Penn State rugby, and, like, the daily training. And, you know, people ask me, like, oh, what'd you go to school for? I sometimes feel like, instead of saying accounting, I sometimes feel like saying, yeah, rugby. I got a degree in rugby, you know?
Yeah, right? I mean, that was intense. I've talked to a lot of people that, so what was it like? They're like, oh, man, what wasn't it like? Like, you know, the 5 a.m., conditioning, and then the weight training, and then the film or practice, or, you know, just back to back to back every single day. And Saturday's your rugby day, so you go and play, and it's back. You know, you have like one day off, but the day is not really spent off. You're getting together and talking about the game and what went wrong, what went right. And then Monday morning, you know, 4:30 conditioning, and those running the were they Farlicks or Fartlicks? What were those called?
Yeah. Maybe Fartlex? I don't know.
Fartlex, yeah.
I think if they said Fartlick, I'd be laughing at them. I don't know. I could be wrong on that. Yeah. Someone should fact check on that.
Yeah, right? Well, those were miserable. And then you had the, they're like, oh, yeah. And like, you remember the 300-yard sprints? Down, back, down, next group up. You're just sucking wind. You can't get enough wind. And then it's another round, you know, 10 of those, and 10 200s, and 10 100-meter sprints. At the end of it, I just remember, we do the circle, the stretch circle. Everyone just kind of sitting there before class after an hour of that and just laying there and just having that ultimate runner's high of like, man, I feel like I am drunk. Oh, I am tuned up.
Dude, you hit the nail on the head. I can vividly remember Westfield and like stretching after those 300 like interval stuff. And I remember looking at the clouds and just like the colors and being like, whoa, I either it's a beautiful sunset or I'm in like a goofy, happy place, you know?
Yeah. Sunset, sunrise. It was like, oh, then everyone would just kind of get up slowly, not talking on their own time, and just kind of like wander off the field like zombies. There was no like joking or, oh, that was fun. Let's go do this. Like, no one really talked. They're like, okay, time to go and think about life, and you go home. Or your place or whatever, and, you know, get some food, and then, which you usually didn't even want to eat after those workouts, before or after, you're just feeling you're going to puke. There's so many people just going to the side and puking. Like, oh man, yeah, unbelievable, incredible training that we did at Penn State. Incredible.
Yeah. Another side. I know we've been going tangents all day, but I used to donate plasma in State College. Just.
Yep. Same. That's how I got my first video camera, I could start filming these hunts. Yep.
So I started, you know, I donate, you get, I don't know, $50 a week or something, an extra $10 if you refer somebody. So, you know, the whole process, you go there, they prick your finger, they check, you know, blood level, iron and all that, your pulse and heart rate. And this was I guess this was my last semester. I was taking it real serious. I was like taking yoga classes to help with rugby. I was like, you know, just taking it super serious like we were. And the one time I went in to donate, and they take my pulse, and they're like, oh, they took my resting heart rate, and they're like, you don't have the minimum heart rate to donate. And I was like, what? They're like, yeah, you're sitting at a 46 right now. I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, it's a minimum of like a 54 or something like that. They're like, do you work out a lot, or are you like an ultra runner or something? And I was like, well, I play rugby. And they're like, oh, okay. All right, well, it'll be fine. Go ahead. We want your plasma. Yeah. But they actually flagged it and like, are you okay? Like, is something wrong with you? I'm like, no, I feel great.
Yeah, it's like, you know, taking the runner high to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
Besides go and donate and then go to practice. And practices were, you know, high intensity, and you go, and then you're like, at the end of practice, like, whoa, maybe I shouldn't have donated all that blood plasma.
Yeah.
Oh man, putting our body to the ultimate test.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I still train, isn't for, I want to look good, feel good, but to hunt up here in Alaska is not just like dragging a deer through the woods. It's, which is still tough, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, packing, doing, you know, 8 trips to a moose kill site with 90 to 130 pounds on your back.
Yeah, you'll find out who you are, you know?
Oh, yeah. John Knapp, man, he dove in. He did great on that moose hunt. He was like, yep, sign me up. Give me that hind quarter. I'm like, dude, you are a champion. So he did great on that hunt. And just, you know, he wants to come back. And that's one of those ones of, yeah, who are you? Your mental toughness level, being soaking wet all day and then dooming a moose and then 6 hours of processing it and then the packing. It will really tell you who you are in a heartbeat and then who your friends are. That's for sure.
Oh,
some guys don't have the best attitude about it. It just, you know, takes a joyous thing into a real negative area. And then at the very end, they're like, oh man, I wish I wouldn't have behaved that way. So. But John did great. John freaking was an animal. My other best friend, Brian Peters, he did great. They loved it, man. And then by the end of it, we're all talking moose strategy and where we think we should go. And, you know, we're huddling around the cell phone, looking at Onyx maps, talking about the swamps we're going to hit. And before you know it, you know, we're slapping hands, hugging, and walking up to a big old down bull moose.
Yeah. And I think that's like the adrenaline rush I'm chasing now, you know? Had rugby, did the Marines, and now I'm like, I need another adventure, you know? So, I mean, I whitetail hunted when I was a teenager and stuff, but, you know, I'm trying to find a place back here to hunt, but now I'm like really looking west just for that next adventure. So.
You just got to move out here, man. Start moving west.
Well,
the wife and the kids in the truck and roll.
Well, I was talking to my wife, and I know this is crazy, but I'm like, you know what? With COVID, people are working remote a lot. That's going to change a lot of stuff. You're like, wait, I don't need to live here? I can live in any state? Huh.
Yep.
That's going to start, you know, making people think.
Oh, it already is. There's a lot of people who are moving up to Alaska just because of that currently. So, but then they get here, and then they realize that it's very cold and dark. During the winter time, pretty depressing, you know. Sunrise is, you know, right now, I believe sunrise is, I could look at it. But sunrise in my handy dandy apps here is, sunrise 10 a.m., sunset 3:37 p.m.
10 to 3:30. That's what you get.
10 to 3:30. Yeah, like right now, I'm looking outside these mountains, and this time of the year, we're getting closer to the winter solstice. So the sun still hasn't peaked up over the mountain, but the sun will peak up over the mountains, wave at us for, you know, an hour or two, and then it's already going down.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty gnarly.
Yeah, but I was born and raised in it. A lot of people have an issue, you know, coming up and dealing with it and making it through their first year. And it's like, wow, this is not exactly what I thought it was going to be. Cold, windy, dark, depressing. And then it turns around, and then the summers are phenomenal. Spring is great. Summers are phenomenal, and fall is the best. And then it starts all over again. So that's why I live here, so I can hunt doll sheep and mountain goats and grizzly bears, you know, all unguided. And that's what I live for. I really live for doll sheep hunting and moose hunting. This year, I don't even know how many goats that I've killed. Wouldn't help people kill in the last 5-6 years, but I went back to back to back to back goat killing five years or something like that in a row, personal goats.
Wow.
And I got out there this year, and I got into position. I was right there on a goat, laid down and looked at it on a solo hunt. I'm like, put it in the rifle scope, 300 yards just under. I'm like, man, this thing's dead. Like, this is going to be a real tough pack out, you know, death-defying pack out. And it's going to roll down and be, you know, meat soup at the bottom of the mountain. I'm like, well, what is this? What does another goat mean to me? And then I thought to myself, like, man, you should have done this with a lever action. You should have done something different, because it was just, it was going through the motions. Flew out, landed, slept that night, woke up the next day, because you can't hunt the same day you're airborne for those species. And hiked up the mountain, got in position. I'm like, wow, that was textbook. And so I turned around and came back down, called the pilots. Yeah, come grab me. I don't need to kill another goat. They're like, you're out there. What the heck? Like, I don't know. You know, bizarre feeling. But the freezer was full with moose meat from the Yukon hunt. Took a whole moose. Everybody in moose camp shot a moose. So we just had a mountain of meat. And I give some away to friends and family. But this year I'm like, I'm gonna keep this whole thing. And now I've got three freezers full, and we've been eating at it as tough as we can. So my freezer was full, and I just kind of felt like my priorities weren't in the right place to go and kill this goat, just because I could, you know, needed to be a little bit different.
You know, I'm just waiting for you for the day where you're like, you know what? I just got this goat with a recurve.
Yeah, it's funny. My recurve actually is Big Jim wrote on it, goat getter. So he really wants me to go kill a goat with a recurve. So I'll do that. Depending on my relationships in the outdoor industry and who's sponsoring me to do what. So it'll all in good time, but I'm looking to keep it spicy. That's why I'm going down to lower 48 and some of these other critters, even with a rifle, because it's new to me. Not hunting or, you know, hunting Western big game in the mountains, but, you know, hunting mule deer on my own DIY, hunting, you know, whitetails in Kansas, different places, and going after different critters in Montana. It's just, it's new, and that's what keeps me going. It's just going, doing something new, testing myself and seeing what I'm made of.
Yeah, man. Well, I'll have to call you back when, once we start getting into the other states, draws, because, man, I could talk this stuff all day.
Same
West, and same thing. I'm like, oh, maybe I save a Wyoming pronghorn for like 2-3 years from now, and maybe I'll do over the counter here while I do this. And so it's, oh man, it's interesting to me. It's cool.
Yeah. Yep. Well, we should do this more often, man. I've got the Mission Alaska cast podcast that I do, and now that hunting season's coming to a close, and getting into my editing and gearing back up for more podcasts and all the draws, and keeping busy when you know, all these hunting seasons are closed down around me. So there's some small games, some stuff that I can get after, but I really save that time away from the family for the big game, for sure.
Oh yeah, you got put in family time. I'm definitely at that spot right now. So
yeah, right. So they can only deal with so much.
Yeah. So you mentioned you do the Alaskast, and you have your website. I mean, do you want to let everyone know where's like the best place to find you or contact you?
Yeah, for all the DIY drop camps, you can just email me, awesomeandelic@gmail.com. You can go and check out the blog articles and what I do at Mission Alaska at missionak.com. But the best way to find me and see what I'm up to on a daily basis is IG, which is mission_Alaska.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah. So, well, thank you for having me on, man. I really appreciate you reaching out to me, and I wish you best of luck with whatever endeavors and then the draw season coming up.
Oh yeah. May the odds be ever in your favor, man. Yeah. No, this was great.
Hey, thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please be sure to like and subscribe. There'll be more content coming. And if you have any questions or comments, you can reach me on Instagram @OutdoorsWithSteve.